call the docket. You may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Timothy Clancy, and I have the pleasure of representing Kimberly Dietz in her appeal from the Court of Appeals. There are two issues that we raised with the Court of Appeals and two assignments of error we respectfully brought to the court. I'll start at the very outset. I'm confident the court has read summary facts both by the appellant and the appellee, and certainly perhaps the appendix. The facts in this case are disturbing. They're certainly of concern to anybody, any human being who would read these facts. The concern as advocate for the appellant is whether or not, and Judge, I've neglected to mention, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal. I apologize.
All right.
We raised two assignments of error for the behavior that took place back in March of 2014. The behavior that took place back in March of 2014 resulted in an allegation or charge that Ms. Dietz, a school teacher, had violated 18.2374.3 subsection B, which was the use of a communication device to promote or procure the use of a minor for any activity in violation of two separate code sections.
Well, can I interrupt you there? But you left out a word that's pretty important. It's for the purpose of procuring
or promoting,
exactly, as opposed to actually procuring or actually promoting.
Yes, sir. So, and that would probably dovetail, I suspect, into my first argument as to whether or not you would need it. Does this involve the what I would consider to be trolling on the internet or the intervention of a third party, or does it involve direct communications with a minor?
Well, how would you divide up the language you just quoted into mens rea and actus reus?
In terms of mens rea, it would be the intent to actually commit the crime, whatever crime, whether it be at 18.2374.1 or 18.2-370. Those are the only two ways you can commit this violation. And 374.1, I think we all agree, does not apply in this case. And it could only be 18.2370, and I think we all further agree it only could be subsection 1 of 18.2370. Subsection 1, which is exposing his or her sexual or genital parts to any child. So that would be the mens rea, that intent. And the actus reus would have to be that offense, because that's the offense that defines the violation of 18.2374.3 subsection B.
Why isn't this more like possession with intent to distribute? The actus reus is simply using the computer, and the mens rea is the purpose, the intent, the subjective will at the time you're using it, as opposed to anything beyond that. This is like a step before solicitation or a step before attempt.
Well, it's certainly a step. It's certainly not solicitation, as we suggested in our brief. We thought it should have been appropriately a solicitation since it was a direct communication.
But what I'm saying is the statute appears to be a step before solicitation.
So if it's a step before solicitation, it still requires the act of, in this case, exposing his or her sexual or genital parts.
Why isn't the act, though, simply the use of the computer? And the mens rea is the purpose for which the act is accompanying the act.
The act is the purpose of using the computer for an activity, and the activity is defined as a violation of 18.2370, in this case, subsection 1. And it was our allegation that the exposure of his or of Ms. Dietz, in this case, we concede that these are sexual parts, not genital parts. But we go on further to argue that the exposure of her sexual parts, the top portion of her breast, if you will, while in the bathtub, did not constitute exposure.
But did it need to? That's the whole question I'm asking.
Well, I think that's the other argument that the Commonwealth, the Attorney General, espoused. The Court of Appeals discounted that.
Well, no, it didn't address it. It said it didn't need to address it in a footnote. It didn't discount it.
Well, it did. It said we don't need to address it because we find that there was an exposure of her sexual parts. We take issue with that. We don't think there was. And we do think it needs to be a completed act to constitute a violation of this code section. So respectfully, Judge, I don't think it's just whatever the intent was. In fact, I think what's interesting in this case is, and the intent, I think you can discern by the dialogue that took place between the undercover detective who assumed the identity of the 11-year-old student and Ms. Dietz. And I'm sure that it's a very brief narrative at the appendix that sets out the text messages between pages 89 through 93. And specifically, the undercover detectives asked for some pictures. Then the undercover detective specifically asked, and excuse the language, asked, says, quote, and this is at page 90 of the appendix, want to see your boobs. Then she sends a photo of the top portion of her breasts, and those are set forth, the photographs of those are at page 96 in the appendix, and then a blow-up, a larger blow-up, so you can see what was sent on that camera at page 98 of the appendix. But I think this is what the key in terms of the intent, if we're concerned about the mens rea, the undercover detective says, well, those are hard to see. I can't see those. The undercover detective says, your arm is in the way. And then she states unequivocally at 91 of the appendix, I didn't want to give you a nipple shot, then you would have seen it all. So I don't believe respectfully that we had, even if I assumed the Commonwealth argument, I don't believe that we had the mens rea to complete the offense of 18.2370 subsection 1 based upon the what was introduced at trial.
A fact finder could not infer the opposite, that she was teasing him and promoting this dialogue for the obvious reasons?
No, I don't think you can ignore the plain facts of what was sent and the plain facts in response to a specific request for a, again, excuse me, a boob shot, and specifically Ms. Dietz, the teacher, saying, I'm not going to do that. I'm not sending you a picture. The picture is very clear. She puts her arm over her breasts and takes a picture of herself and sends those pictures. I think if I assumed...
What other purpose would she be sending this to an 11-year-old child?
She does, and I began my comments with this body that these facts are not good, they're not appropriate.
My only question is, what other intent, other than lascivious intent, would she possibly have to send those photographs, whatever their level of exposure, to an 11-year-old child?
Even if I assumed the argument that she had the lascivious intent, then the question becomes, if I had the lascivious intent and I sent the top portion of my breasts, not only is that not a violation of 18.2370 subsection 1, it clearly shows an intent, a mens rea, not to commit that charge. I don't know how you can ignore that respectfully.
Well, you don't ignore it. The last footnote of the Court of Appeals opinion, the argument of the Commonwealth, is you don't need it. All you need is the mens rea at the time of using the computer, not a completed, consummated act.
I would agree. But if we're trying to discern intent, which obviously is always very difficult, we sort of can't look in people's brains and we have to discern intent, I don't know how respectfully you can ignore what the undercover specifically requested and what was specifically sent. The complaint by the undercover, I can't see anything, your arm is in the way, and then the response unequivocally, I'm not going to give you a nipple shot, then you would have seen it all. So even if I assumed the Commonwealth's argument in this case, that you only have to show that's the mens rea, well, clearly she indicated she was not going to commit that crime. She had no intent to commit a violation of 18.2370 subsection 1.
She didn't know about that statute specifically. When you look at the entire three pages, she clearly knew that what she was doing violated the school policy, and I'm guessing she probably knew that it violated state law. Can we not find that intent throughout the entire three-page narrative?
Well, I don't think anybody's ever required that none of us, even me doing this for all these years, know every statute. So I'm not suggesting for a moment she knew the existence or non-existence of the statute. But we're still required as triers of fact and appellate courts when we examine the propriety of the trial of fact as to whether or not her conduct, be it her intent and her conduct, violated a criminal statute. And I would suggest it did not.
Because you have pulled out one text out of the entire transaction, which went on for a considerable period of time.
You're right, but But don't we have to, if she sent a picture of her lips, or the picture of when she, picture of her lips, or picture of her leg, or picture of her face.
It was a picture of her breast, it was a picture of her leg, both in the bathtub, and everything she said throughout that entire conversation. Do we not look at the entire conversation when we're trying to make that determination?
I think
plus both pictures.
I think you can look at that entire conversation. Be mindful of the fact, and I'm sure you are, that there was a stipulation that was introduced prior to trial that nothing in the text discerned or involved explicit language or lascivious intent. That was a stipulation entered into
stipulation.
Between Commonwealth and
nonetheless, the entire conversation informs the photographs.
It does. It absolutely does. And that's why I began my comments by saying this was inappropriate. She knew it was wrong. No teacher should be communicating with an 11-year-old child. But did she violate a statute, whether she knew the statute was in existence or not? I mean, that's the whole basis why we're standing here, is to examine her conduct. Certainly, you weren't the triers of fact. We have to give Judge Taylor every inference from which the could be drawn from this evidence, but you still have to look and say, even if I adopt Judge Kelsey's point of view, that the mens rea is all that has to be proved, the intent to commit the crime, clearly, by her own language, she had no desire or intent to commit that crime. She made it clear she was not going to violate the statute, whether she knew it exists or not. I'm not sure that's really relevant, Judge. I know she was under a mandate. Teachers aren't supposed to communicate with students, particularly via text. I would agree that that's inappropriate. She knew what she was doing was inappropriate. The issue is whether or not what she did was criminal or not. And that's why we're before you up here in Richmond, to examine what she did. So that would be my response. Does the court have any other questions? I'm very near to my 3 minutes, so I'll step back.
All right, you have 3 minutes and 22 seconds.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth in this appeal. Your Honors, it's important to note that the statute the defendant was found guilty of in this case is a statute that criminalizes using a communication system to facilitate certain offenses against children. And as the court has already discussed, the actus reus in this case is the using of the communication system to contact the children or to commit certain offenses against children. And in this case, the mens rea is that intent of using it in order for the purpose to promote or procure a minor. The evidence in this case showed that the defendant used a cell phone to send text messages to someone she believed was a minor, to someone who she believed was the 11-year-old child that she taught, and those text messages coupled together with the context of the relationship and the photographs she sent, clearly showed that she was intending to procure the use of that minor in order to expose herself or commit any offense in violation of 18.2370. Therefore, the trial court properly found her guilty of violating 18.2374.3b, and the Court of Appeals and the trial court should be affirmed.
I have had a couple of questions. Clearly, the conduct is shocking. There's no question about that. But our challenge is it unlawful in the manner in which she has been charged? And it may very well be. I'm trying to figure out how the communications actually inform the intent. And it's pretty clear to me what the intent is that she had. But if she were to say, for example, simply have a photograph of her in a bathing suit that she used at a beach, there are bathing suits that are far more revealing than these photographs. What you're saying is that the communications actually inform what she was intending to do, and absent the communications, you wouldn't have an offense. But with the communications, you do.
Yes, Your Honor. With the communications and the context of this case, you have an offense. Certainly, there are going to be circumstances where breasts that are not completely exposed or are not sexual parts. But the intent and the total context of the conversation informs that the picture of her breasts in this case were sexual parts. For example, if you saw a mother breastfeeding in public, that is not necessarily a sexual part, but it is a sexual part in
this case. Certainly the lascivious intent wouldn't be there. Maybe that's a distinction.
Certainly, Your Honor. And
well, that's where I was going. I don't understand the stipulation. Why is there a stipulation in the case that apparently the Commonwealth agreed to that there was no lascivious intent?
The Commonwealth submits that stipulation and how the Court of Appeals also analyzed it went to the message of the text message words themselves were not lascivious in nature. However, when you take the context of all the text messages and the communications coupled with the photographs was sent and the relationship, you get to the defendant's lascivious intent, which is what this court is more interested in, is what is the defendant's intent, not what is the intent of the text messages themselves. I know that stipulation is confusing. Obviously, I was not part of that case at that point.
I bet you wish it wasn't there.
There are plenty of things I wish may or may not be in a record, Your Honor, but unfortunately, the record we have in front of us still clearly demonstrates that the defendant in this case had lascivious intent when she was conducting this conversation.
Well, I agree with that. I just can't fathom why a Commonwealth's attorney would enter into such a stipulation. Go ahead.
I see your point, Your Honor. But again, it is very important, the context of the messages. The defendant was the teacher of the minor child. She lied when she obtained his phone number, telling him she was going to give it to another student, and then she instigated the conversations, reaching out to him. She continued to text him. She said inappropriate things, such as she wished he was 18, she wanted to kiss him. She recognized she would get fired and go to jail if anyone saw the messages she was sending him.
I'm sorry, may I interrupt you again?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Going back to the stipulation, tell me if I'm reading it correctly. The stipulation is limited to the narrative of the text. So it's limited to the literal words on the text boxes. But it doesn't take into account the background facts, and it doesn't take into account the context of the photographs.
That would absolutely be the Commonwealth's position.
So am I right or wrong? The stipulation is simply, if you wrote these words out on a piece of paper and handed it to someone, that would not in and of themselves without anything more be lascivious intent.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But we have more.
We do have more, Your Honor. And as I was saying, what we have is the relationship, the photographs, just the completely inappropriate nature of it. As the Court of Appeals recognized, the only reasonable conclusion of these text messages and her conduct was that she was attempting to sexually entice an 11-year-old boy when she sent these photographs and messages, and therefore the evidence was sufficient. However, as the Commonwealth argued both at the Court of Appeals and in this court, the Commonwealth didn't even need to go that far to prove a violation of 18.2374.3b. The Commonwealth only needed to prove her intent was to promote or procure the use of a child in order to violate that the 18.2370 in the future. This statute, the use of a communication device, is a statute that is intended to protect children before sexual offenses are committed against them. So the Commonwealth did not need to prove that a sexual offense had actually been committed against this child, only that the defendant was attempting to promote or procure the use of a child in order to commit the enumerated sexual offenses. And I think that is very important to this case in analyzing it. To turn briefly to the defendant's first assignment of error, the Court of Appeals correctly declined to put a third-party requirement into the statute that is clearly not in the plain wording of the statute. If you read the statute, it merely says it is unlawful for any person to use a communication system, including but not limited to computers or computer networks or bulletin boards or any other electronic means for the purpose of procuring and promoting the use of a minor. There is no third-party requirement in that. There is no meaning from the words procure or promote to indicate that a third party is necessary, and clearly a defendant could complete that act simply by directly communicating with a minor. Therefore, if the court has no further questions, the Commonwealth would ask that you affirm the conviction.
All right, rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. I certainly understand the court's comments. I guess my observation would be, and it's a rhetorical question, and then I'll respond, no, certainly not presumptuous enough to ask you to answer, but is anybody concerned of which of these four photographs would have violated 18.2370 subsection 1? Would it be the lips? Would it be the toes? Would it be the leg, or the face rather? Or would it be the top portion of the breasts?
Well, can I answer your rhetorical question?
I suspected you would, Jesse.
Isn't the answer that we don't have to go that far? That this is a step prior to that. This is a statute designed to be prophylactic, to draw a bright line, not even promoting, not even procuring. It's as I said before, it seems to be a line drawn before solicitation, before attempt, and certainly before actual consummation of the act. So why don't we give those words purpose of procuring or promoting that interpretation?
I would certainly, if that's the way the court's predisposed to rule, then I think I go back and I don't want to reiterate my time, but then you have to look at what actually happened.
No, I agree.
And what her intent was. And despite two separate requests by the undercover assuming the identity of the 11-year-old, she refused to comply with exposing her sexual or genital parts to the child.
Well, at that point, she would have had a consummated act. My whole point is, doesn't the statute criminalize something prior to that?
Well, then I think then it can, but you can't look in people's brains, so if you're trying to discern intent from conduct and from the circumstances surrounding that conduct, and I don't know how you can unequivocally disregard the request to show her boobs and her refusal to do so. That would be my respectful response to you, Judge. So then I get back to, if it does require a completed act, no completed act took place. The top portion of the breast, no matter what, whether it's a definition of nudity under the code, or as Justice Lemon says, we see worse than that in bathing suits or in Sports Illustrated magazines and those kind of things, that's the top portion of the breast could not be construed as sexual. There cannot be construed as exposure of sexual parts, I should say. I certainly think breasts would be sexual parts. If buttocks are sexual parts, breasts are certainly sexual parts. I'm not making that argument. But I think this court defined what needs to be exposed, and I'm going to butcher this case, the Farhomand case cited in my brief, that that involved, you guys, this court respectfully analyzed what the meaning of exposure was. You use the Webster's definition, and it requires a visual display where the genitals are actually seen. That involved touching and or seeing, and the court disregarded any charges under 370.1 where simply genitals were touched.
Well,
and
counsel,
not seen.
On the intent question, the stipulations also indicate that she lied about the reason she wanted this phone number. Right? She requested his phone number, lied about the reason she wanted his phone number, and then blocked her number when she sent him the first text messages.
She did, and she admitted in a microphone.
So what do you conclude from that?
What do I?
How do you get around that with regard to intent?
I think she knew what she did was wrong. That doesn't mean she knew what she did violated a criminal statute.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
It seems like to me what you're saying is what the statute requires is that she procure or promote the use of the child for the purpose of showing this child her sexual parts. And you're saying she obviously did not intend to do that because she refused to do so when she was asked.
Not only did she, if I can have the moment, I know I'm flashing. There are, if I adopt Justice Kelsey and the Attorney General's opinion, decision or interpretation of the statute, if it's simply intent and not actually a completed act for a violation of exposing one's sexual or genital parts, then I think you look at the plain language of what was requested by the undercover. Clearly she didn't have the intent to expose. So then if you require an actual, if it actually requires a completed act, be it any one of those options under 18.2370, the only one that applies here is the exposure of her sexual or genital parts. And I would respectfully suggest, based upon this court's precedent, we do not have an exposure of her breasts, which I'm conceding, although there's no case law from this court, as to whether breasts are sexual parts or not, I'm conceding for argument, for obviously I think they are, but there was no exposure. Simply
what
the
if
top.
She's grooming the child?
Well,
curing or promoting? What if she's grooming the child?
I can't respond to that, Judge. That's far afield of what this case was. This was an isolated incident that took
far
place.
Far afield of what this case was, if she's setting him up for the next series of
this
photos?
Was an event that took place on March 2, 2014, for which she was charged and found guilty. To assume that she was grooming him, whether that's right or wrong, I don't think changes the analysis as to whether or not a crime took place on March 2, 2014. So that's how I would respond to that.
Can I ask one last question before you sit down? Is the stipulation that nothing in the narrative was lascivious a stipulation of law?
No, I don't know that. I think it would have to be a stipulation of fact.
Well, it seems to me that with the statutes that you're dealing with, that it may very well be a stipulation of law, because to get to that level of intent is one of the requirements of the various statutes, that some of them that you cited. In any event, when I asked the question about the stipulation, it's because I can't imagine why it was made. But I'm concerned that it's not binding in any event, because that question is a question of law, whether it rises to the level of being lascivious. And perhaps this is a great way to end this hearing. This is the text. You just have no idea what kind of things I'd do to you if you were 18. Can't even begin to tell you so many dirty things. That's lascivious.
Yes, sir.
All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.